Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 2nd of September. We missed Labor Day yesterday because it was Labor Day, so we took the day off. So we thought we would do all things political this hour of the program. The New York Times Labor Day editorial, How to Buy a Mine in Wisconsin, which focused on the $700,000 mining donation, a tough editorial on Governor Walker. We'll ask our guest to respond. And now that we have officially begun the campaign season, is Mary Burke's strategy of getting out of the way as her opponent is buried in bad news a good strategy? President Obama in Milwaukee yesterday at Labor Fest calling on Congress to raise the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. The president said by almost every measure, the American economy, the American workers are better off than when he took office. If that's the case, why are wages and salaries not leading to improved living standards? How to stop ISIS and the Russian action in Ukraine also on our to-be-discussed list today. And as everyone goes back to school this week, some talk about charter schools. Our guest has written about FBI raids, and there's more than just one on charter schools. Ruth Conniff is our guest this hour, editor of the Progressive magazine. She is also a regular on television programs on CNN, Fox News, PBS, and appears frequently on PBS's To the Contrary and on the Ed Schultz Show on MSNBC. She was the recipient of an Editor's Choice Award from Madison Magazine for her coverage of the Wisconsin Uprising in 2011, and she's written about all kinds of different issues. We thought we would start with the race for governor in the state of Wisconsin because there's so much there and we haven't talked about it extensively. And Ruth is up to speed on all of that. And I thought I would give you a chance to call in and give your thoughts about this race that would appear to be, according to the Marquette University poll, pretty evenly divided right now. Here's our phone number for you to join All Things Political for this Tuesday. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Ruth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, great to be with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's start with the race for governor, and let's start with the New York Times Labor Day editorial, How to Buy a Mine in Wisconsin. It was a pretty tough editorial on Governor Walker. What did you make of that, and do you think that he's getting a similar kind of treatment from the press in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this story has been big news in Wisconsin for some time. So if you read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, if you read the Wisconsin State Journal, you've been reading a lot about that particular $700,000 donation to Walker and the subsequent legislation that favored that mine. Incredibly controversial legislation in Wisconsin, opening the largest open pit iron ore mine in the world in this very sensitive watershed on the shores of Lake Superior. What's surprising to see the New York Times take it up as their lead topic. And I think the reason that they did that on their editorial page is because Walker really represents this incredibly aggressive takeover of politics by big money, by shadowy, dark money forces. And the investigation that has led to the exposure of that, of how it worked, of how his advisor gave him his marching orders to go and see Sheldon Adelson, to go and see Donald Trump, to shake them down for particular amounts of money, and how he then visited with them and that money came in to the coffers of the Club for Growth, which was carefully explained in these same emails, meant that both the amounts and the donors didn't have to be disclosed. You know, you see the whole operation of dark money and its distorting effect on politics in these documents that are being released. And if you're a real nerd and you've been following it really closely, as we have at The Progressive, it's a very compelling story. But I think it's also now risen to the level of top national news because it's so flagrant and it's so much on people's minds generally, nationally, in this election cycle. And here is a very specific example of an out-of-state mine owner who wanted particular types of deregulation and the shutdown of public hearings in order to push through this particular project. You see this large donation that was undisclosed, and then you see that legislation passed over the objections of a lot of people. So it's a very vivid example of something that's been very much in the shadows.
And what about about the issue, Ruth, of Wisconsin having a tougher set of campaign regulations than many other states so that it would be perceived by many as, oh, this is business as usual when it comes to campaigning now?
Well, it's interesting. I heard that observation made on a national NPR show this morning.
So did I.
They were talking about Walker.
I know.
So it's interesting to sit in Wisconsin and hear pundits in D.C. say, well, you know, this might be regular business in New Jersey, but those Wisconsinites like this thing called clean government.
Right.
And I think that's something to be proud of. You know, it's true. I mean, we have had these laws in effect since 1977, right after Watergate, when we decided as residents of the state that we wanted transparency, we wanted disclosure, we wanted limits on contributions, and furthermore, we wanted to set up the GAB, the Government Accountability Board, a bunch of retired judges, not partisan political hacks, you know, would not shift from party to party in its control, to really monitor what was going on in our politics and to do something to stop basically flagrant bribery in order to overturn the public interest. And that's our tradition in Wisconsin. So, you know, to say, well, everybody's doing it, and, you know, look, Chris Christie, look at how he operates. It's not good enough for Wisconsinites. And I think people really do care about whether their government is bought and have a real strong investment. And it's a legal reality that folks like the Club for Growth, who want to run roughshod over politics all over the country, it's a legal reality they face here in our state.
Tell me what the latest is with the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. What are we waiting for? What emails may be released soon? What's the status?
Well, we don't know specifically what new information is going to come out. We've seen a whole lot of information. Next week, there will be a set of hearings particularly on the issue of disclosure. And what's interesting, and we have been following this very closely at the Progressive, and Brendan Fisher, who is our general counsel and legal reporter, is going to be attending those Seventh Circuit hearings and reporting on them on our website at progressive.org. But he has actually today published sort of a long explanation of where we are in this winding court case. And, you know, the argument that has been so aggressively advanced by the Wall Street Journal editorial page and by the Club for Growth that there's no violation, that this is a partisan witch hunt, that these disclosure rules are unnecessary, or if they exist, should be overturned. You know, all of that, I think, is belied by the facts that have emerged in this case. For example, we now know that the Government Accountability Board itself hired the prosecutor, a Republican, Fran Schmidt, who's leading this case, who spends most of his time actually prosecuting terrorists. That really undermines the idea that this is a partisan witch hunt. We know that Walker was raising campaign funds for the Club for Growth, and that the explanation for that was that they wanted to not have this sort of disparate ads. They wanted them to be coordinated in the recall elections, and particularly the Senate recall elections. We have the specific marching orders for him to go to particular contributors and raise funds. So, you know, there's a whole lot that has emerged in this case lately, and we've seen all these new headlines lately. And so the argument, and we actually have a very good piece dissecting this argument that Walker is not a target. There was a quote from Fran Schmidt saying, Walker is not a target, as if that exonerated him, and exploring that that does not necessarily mean that he was not being investigated, that there was no wrongdoing there. And in fact, if the prosecutor had said he was a target, he would have been required to press charges right then. So that, I mean, I think, you know, if you really want to look deeply into what's going on in this court case, you know, it's really interesting. But the larger sort of the pullback for folks who are just watching politics and are not necessarily following every twist and turn is that, my God, you know, here's Walker getting this advice to run out and raise funds from Sheldon Adelson and others for the Club for Growth, and he's doing it. I mean, one takeaway is Walker was a great fundraiser for this right-wing group, and the amount of money that poured in from out of state into the election is more than we ever knew.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at the way the campaign is being carried out. You talk about Mary Burke's strategy of getting out of the way as her opponent is buried in bad news. Is that a winning strategy for Mary Burke?
Well, I would not have said so. But if you look at, you know, three Marquette polls in a row and you see that she has dead even and even, you know, within the error margin now leading Walker, you got to say it's hard to argue with success. I mean, I think what you see in those polls is not so much Wisconsinites rushing to want to vote for Mary Burke as they are just turned off by Walker with all of the scandal news and also with the really poor economic news for our state. So I think that combination has been deadly for him. And Burke's strategy, you know, I compare her in the piece where I said that to Tommy Thompson, actually. And just remembering, for most of my childhood, Tommy Thompson was the governor of Wisconsin. And for most of that time, he and Sue Ann Thompson were pictured on the state map of Wisconsin, posing with their bicycles and waving happily. And that was a different era. You know, I mean, that's a very well-remembered era in Wisconsin, sort of a friendly era in Wisconsin politics. And I think Mary Burke and her Trek bicycle are looking better and better for the Wisconsin state map. But you know, it is a strategy that involves partially conserving funds. I mean, Mary Burke has not gone up on the air with a big ad campaign because she doesn't have the kind of money that Scott Walker and his allies have to just bomb the airwaves with ads. And so she's been holding back, and we're going to see more in the last closing months of the campaign.
New York Times had a piece yesterday or today: at risk in the Senate, Democrats seek to rally black Democrats to mobilize African Americans outraged by the shooting in Ferguson. Black churches and on black talk radio, civic leaders have begun looking at the death of Michael Brown and trying to get people to the polls based on that. I want to move the conversation to that in a moment, but it seems to me as though Mary Burke needs to, she'd have to win, obviously, Milwaukee by a large margin, and of course, Madison, Dane County as well. She hasn't been in Milwaukee very often, and I'm wondering about the African-American vote in this city, voting in large numbers for Barack Obama, but don't you have to have some kind of push to get people to the polls, and this could be the margin of victory for her?
Absolutely. I think the entire race is going to come down to a get-out-the-vote drive, and that is going to be absolutely the deciding factor. And there is a very motivated, solid base for Walker that will come to the polls. And the question is whether the Democrats can get the folks who are likely to vote for Burke to just come out and cast that vote.
And that would be different than what you see nationally, where polling is showing that Republican voters are more engaged in elections, at least nationally at this point, which could be a predictor of a Senate change to Republican.
Well, the latest Marquette poll has an interesting feature, which is that people who are likely to vote say they're more likely to vote for Burke. So I think the enthusiasm has shifted in her direction, but it really is an issue of just, you know, feet on the ground, getting people to polls. And, you know, that is it's a harder climb now because of voter suppression, because we're making it harder for people to vote.
So when we see ads, I've already seen a lot of ads for her, actually, in the Milwaukee area. When we see an influx of ads in the next few weeks, will we see about 50-50, or does Walker have a whole lot more money?
I think he has so much more money that it's unlikely we'll see 50-50, but I think Mary Burke has some serious support. I mean, she's not, you know, a tiny grassroots candidate. This is not the Joanne Clappenberg campaign. She's got Emily's List behind her. She looks like a comer now. She's got all these polls showing that she could do it. And so I think she's going to get some real support, and I think she's going to be able to be a serious force.
We're going to talk about the minimum wage, which will be much discussed during the course of this week. The president in Milwaukee yesterday at Labor Fest calling on Congress to raise the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10. We'll talk to Ruth about that. And also look at this. You know, the economy is evidently improving, but it doesn't seem to be leading to higher wages for people, higher salaries for people. People don't feel as though they're getting ahead. What's going on? Why is there this disparity? Ruth has done some very interesting work on charter schools, and we think about charter schools and school as we all go back to school this week. So we'll talk about FBI raids on charter schools. And, of course, ISIS very much in the news again this week, the Russian action in Ukraine. We will talk about that as well. And welcome your phone calls. I'm interested in your thoughts because we haven't talked about it very much. Our guests tend to have a national focus, but Ruth knows Wisconsin politics. What you think of the governor's race in the state of Wisconsin? Do you think that Governor Walker has been damaged by the recent round of revelations, particularly the mining story, which seems to have more traction than anything else and is getting at least some national attention? Or do you think that, well, it is politics as usual? Well, we may not like it, but that's the way the game is played right now, so you're not crazy about it. What about her campaign strategy of not being front and center, responding to the latest information that's come out and not being real visible at Laborfest in Milwaukee? Is it a good strategy to just let this information come out that's not very positive for the governor and not really respond to it? What do you make of the polls that show that it's pretty much even at this point in time? Really interested in your response to that, and we'll move into other issues momentarily. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, that would be great. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Ruth Conniff is our guest this hour. Ruth is the editor of the Progressive magazine. She's a native of Madison, Wisconsin, and joined the magazine when she was hired as a summer intern after her sophomore year at Yale. She is a regular on TV pundit shows, CNN, Fox News, PBS, also on PBS's The Contrary and The Ed Schultz Show on MSNBC. Phone lines are filled right now, so send a message if you want to get through immediately. If not, just wait a little while, and the phone will be available for you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655. A special emphasis on the governor's race in the state of Wisconsin. We'll take those calls first and then move into minimum wage. Lee in Spooner is our first call. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'd like to say that I've been a Democrat and a liberal for more than 40 years, but I'm tired of voting for Democrats based on the idea that they are just the lesser evil. And unless Mary Burke comes out with some policies that appear to really help wage-earning Americans, I doubt seriously that I will vote for her.
You would vote for Governor Walker then?
No, I just wouldn't vote.
Ah. Ruth.
Well, I mean, that's certainly that's how some people feel. And in fact, that's the question in the race, you know, from the beginning when people were talking about who would the candidate be. And the candidate is a pro-business moderate. And that's not really the energy that drove the recall of the governor. It's not the response to his historic attack on collective bargaining rights that a lot of folks who were really activated to come out to those incredible protests in Madison are thinking about. It's not what they had in mind. On the other hand, Mary Burke has moved a long way. She is, you know, definitely a big supporter of increasing the minimum wage. She's made student debt a key issue in her campaign, which puts her in the category of progressive Democrats, you know, across the country who are recognizing just the driver of inequality that student debt is and that crisis for this next generation of kids coming out of college. You know, the outsourcing issue is a serious issue. Walker has been running television ads talking about Trek Bicycle outsourcing some of its operations to China. That's not fooling around in Wisconsin, which is still very much manufacturing is very much a critical employer in our state. And people forget that sometimes if they live in communities like Madison, which is all state government and university employees and not manufacturing driven. But manufacturing is really important for us. On the other hand, you know, the reason that Walker is attacking Mary Burke on outsourcing those jobs is because it turns out that he has replaced the Commerce Department with this quasi-private agency, the WEDC, that is handing money to companies in order almost to outsource. He's giving grants to companies that have then closed their plants here and outsourced jobs, a far, far bigger problem with outsourcing than Burke faces. So, you know, I can understand where the color is coming from. You know, I get it. And I think that's a factor for Burke. And I think, you know, that enthusiasm of the base is tied to voter turnout, which we were talking about before. But nonetheless, I think what has happened, and I say this, you know, in the article that you cited, Kathleen, is that things have gotten so bad for Walker that the folks who didn't come out in the recall, the folks who didn't even like the idea of a recall and supported Walker or stayed home, you know, a lot of people who are not that active base have decided that they've had enough of economic decline and corruption. And I think that may ultimately be what decides this race more than the activists.
So you're voting for who you're against?
Well, that is very often a syndrome that we face in, you know, in elections. We look at two candidates and we pick the best option, and it's not representative of our activist politics. But, you know, I have done a lot of reporting on this over a lot of years, and I followed Ralph Nader around in 2000, and he was certainly a far more compelling candidate from a progressive point of view than Al Gore. And it was really interesting to see that whole race unfold. And there was I do not condemn people who voted for Nader. I totally understand the feeling of outrage that they had when, you know, people, Democrats, were deployed to Wisconsin to beat people over the head and say, you know, how dare you vote your conscience, as Nader put it. You know, you got to get in line and vote for the person that we're putting up in front of you. And people don't respond well to that. You know, and it's not a winning formula long term for having a more progressive politics.
Well, the other question I had, Ruth, and you'll be able to answer this, is considering the importance of the Wisconsin election, considering what's happened to the state over the last 4 years, why weren't there Democrats who were standing in line to run against the governor?
Yeah, that is a really interesting, in-depth article. You know, why does the political infrastructure in Wisconsin not produce a bench with some depth,
right,
so that, you know, we think of these individual stars. We think of Russ Feingold. And there's such a huge grassroots yearning for him to run in the recall election. You know, you have a Tammy Baldwin, who's a tremendously talented individual candidate. You know, you have these individual folks in the Democratic Party, but what you don't have is a structure that produces a bench and moves young people up through the ranks. And some of it is actually our progressive tradition. We don't have ward healers. You know, we're not Illinois. We're not Chicago. You know, we don't have that kind of structure. And some of it is just, you know, a lack of organization. We need a party that's knit together in progressive enclaves throughout the state locally, and that's moving people up, and that is really coming together to produce a more progressive politics. And one effort at trying to rebuild that actually is something that the Progressive Magazine is now involved in, which is Fighting Bob Fest, which is coming up September 13th in Baraboo. This idea that we need to create progressive chapters, you know, setting aside the party, you know, the Democratic Party politics, but a progressive politics that brings people together around issues and that really pushes for progressive policy in our state.
Thanks, Lee, very much for your call. Diana in Preston. Hi, Diana.
Hi, I live in Trempealeau County, and frac sand mining is a very big issue here. And the out-of-state corporate influence has been very great, from everything from the very basic local all the way up to the governor's office. The 1,000-acre mine that's proposed to go in and back of me is the same by the same company, purportedly by the same company that Scott Walker came to Arcadia area to tout, even though they opened up illegally. I also would like to say I have a sign on the back of my car that I made, and it says, "Vote, use it, or lose it." Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call. It's a very large issue in that part of the state, isn't it? Very large issue.
Yeah, I think people feel daunted by being up against these enormous corporate forces, and that the antidote to that is to get people together, to feel empowered, to do something as a group, and not to feel that there's no hope and you just have to roll over and give up. And I think you can both have a strong desire for a really progressive candidate and also see that there are separate issues when it comes to voting and politics and the candidate that, you know, best moves things along in the direction you want it to, and then the longer term organizing effort. And I have to say, like in that reporting I was talking about on Ralph Nader, I reported on Students for Nader after the 2000 election, the folks who were still behind Nader after a lot of people had their ears blown back by the results in the presidential election of 2000 and felt like that was a disaster. And I talked to Howard Zinn, who was at the time a columnist for the Progressive Magazine, the author of the great People's History of America, because he was often invoked by the Students for Nader as a real radical and somebody who would not put up with this corporate Democratic Party. And he said, look, you know, Nader got distracted by the last thing he should have been distracted by, which was electoral politics. You vote for who you're going to vote for. Of course I'm going to vote for the person who's going to, you know, be the least worst candidate. But that's not the sum total of my activism. My activism is going to be, as the caller mentioned, in her community, frac sand mining. It's going to be the issues that really matter on a grassroots level. And the politicians are going to have to follow the people who really push on those issues. And it seems to me that that was a really sensible, nice place to be.
Marcus in Green Bay. Hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm concerned about Mary Burke as far as her being a governor. I kind of agree with Lee, a previous caller. Once a lot of people learned about Governor Walker's policies, there were demonstrations unequaled at our state capitol. There was so much energy and potential energy for Mary Burke or whoever would oppose Governor Walker. And I'm just leery on what she may be as a governor, because she seems a little bit asleep at the wheel. I believe that she maybe could be out there a lot more and grasp that energy from, you know, opposition people of Governor Walker. And there's not a lot of effort put forth, it seems like, on her part.
Do you plan to vote, Marcus?
Pardon me?
Do you plan to vote?
Yes, I do, and I unlike the previous caller, I think I still will vote for her, the lesser of two evils, if you may say that. Yes, I darn tootin' I'll vote.
Okay, just wondering. All right, thank you. I hear a lot of that people wonder where she is.
I think that there is a strange feeling about coming through those mass protests and being in the midst of that and that outpouring of sentiment, and then ending up with this medium cool candidate who wasn't really there for all of that. Mm-hmm. There is an emotional disconnect there. And I think Mary Burke has worked hard to overcome that. I mean, for one thing, I talked to her early in the race. She reached out to lefties around the state in a strategic way because her positions are not, you know, she did not, unlike Kathleen Falk, who came out and said that she would make it such a priority to reverse Act 10 that she wouldn't pass, she would veto any budget that didn't include it. Mary Burke has not taken a stand like that. She has been careful about that. And I wondered early in her campaign if that enthusiasm gap would do her in, because it seemed in some ways comparable to Barrett's campaign, actually both the first and second time. You know, and the second time it was almost insulting, I think, to some voters that it was just a redo of the previous election when Barrett ran in the recalls. Like, you made the wrong choice. Here's your opportunity to choose again. And people said, nope, not choosing him. But what has happened is with these three Marquette polls, Mary Burke has climbed out of the hole that Barrett never climbed out of. He was 7% down in every Marquette poll, and that is the amount he lost by in the recall election. So I think we're in a different place politically. It is not the same place we were in the recall. It is not as much driven by that desire to overthrow Walker immediately for this outrageous action on collective bargaining. It is more about jobs and the economy and the sense that he's just giving tax dollars away to corporations that are closing plants and moving out of state because there is campaign donors. All he cares about is this presidential election that's coming up. We're lagging the entire region for job creation, which was supposed to be his signature issue. Come on. And so it's a less heartfelt, you know, kind of gut moving thrust in the race this time. But I have to admit, to my surprise, it does seem to be working for Mary Burke. Mm-hmm. Without connecting with that really impassioned base, she nonetheless seems to be moving a lot farther ahead than Barrett ever did.
It's very interesting. Let's talk about the president's appearance in Milwaukee yesterday at Labor Fest, talking about the minimum wage, asking it to go to $10.10 an hour. He said, by almost every measure, the American economy, the American workers are better off than when he took office. And yet, you would probably be hard-pressed, Ruth, to find a whole lot of people who feel that they're better off financially. What's the disconnect?
Well, what has actually happened nationally is that the recovery has been, you know, though anemic, steady, and we have climbed back to 2007, pre-2007 employment numbers. But there's more people looking for work than there were in 2007. So, you know, it's it's true that the economy has recovered, and it's true that the president did a few really important things with the stimulus, with the rescue of the auto industry, that put us in a place where we would not be. And the minimum wage is a no-brainer. It is enormously popular to increase the minimum wage. It is something that most Americans want, and the Republicans are really out of touch on this issue. So, you know, things are somewhat better, but they're not all the way better. And Wisconsin particularly is suffering because our recovery is half the size of the nation. So we are lagging the national average. You know, we have 2-to-1 fewer jobs than the average in the nation in gains in the recovery. So, you know, things are somewhat better. They're not all the way better. The president's appearance in Milwaukee at Labor Fest reminded me of the Tammy Baldwin campaign. She became the opening act for President Obama for a while. He made several appearances where she got to introduce him in Wisconsin. And what I found fascinating about that in 2012 was that it didn't seem so much that Obama was helping Tammy. It seemed like Tammy was helping Obama in Wisconsin because she would talk about trade and manufacturing, which, again, are critical issues in our state. And she would talk about unfair trade deals. She had this whole theme of fairness. We need marriage equality, and we need a fair shake for workers, and we need to increase the minimum wage. And he began to adopt some of those talking points in Wisconsin, which is really interesting from a guy who is currently in the midst of negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a job-killing trade deal. So his politics are not where Tammy's are, progressive, pro-worker, economic growth politics. But he can point to a couple of things, and being in favor of an increase in the minimum wage is absolutely a hugely popular position.
Eric in Florida, hi.
Hey, two comments, if you don't mind. The first one, democracy only works if people know what's best for them. And why anyone in their right mind wouldn't vote for Obama or the Democrats in this election is just goes to prove that that's the case. If you're in the upper 50%, you're killing it by whatever measure you want to use. You can use the stock market. You can use your retirement. You can use, you know, 401k, whatever you want to use. You're killing it if you're in the upper 50%. If you're in the lower 50%, Obama's trying to move those people up, too, by increasing the minimum wage, making college more affordable, closing the loopholes on the wealthy, and so on and so on and so forth. So everyone in America should be voting for Democrats if they were voting for what was best for them. My second comment is the wealthy aren't paying their taxes anymore. And people keep talking about America's broke. America's not broke. America is awash in money. And yet people like Mitt Romney, whose father probably paid something like 50 or 60% in taxes back in the 1950s and 60s. We've changed the tax laws now to the point where the rich don't pay any taxes at all. Or they pay, in Mitt Romney's case, 11%. They've got trillions of dollars hidden in offshore accounts. Corporations have trillions of dollars in profits. Banks are sitting on trillions of dollars. We are awash in money, and the fact that we are not releasing it, that money is not moving anymore, it's stuck. It's all accumulating and stuck at the top, is the fact that the Republican Party has somehow managed to convince everybody. And I don't know how it's the most magical thing that I've ever seen in my life, that it's in the best interest of the American people that rich people don't pay their taxes anymore.
Ruth.
Yeah, I agree. I think you should come to Fighting Bob Fest in Baraboo and hear Bernie Sanders, because that is almost word for word part of Bernie Sanders' stump speech. And he's going to come talk about what's going on in American politics and, you know, what needs to happen to really address inequality and represent the interests of the people again. And I think it's absolutely right that it is maddening to see the interests of the huge majority of people neglected, and somehow the interests of corporations and billionaires in not paying their fair share confused with freedom, you know, and that's a real sales job that's been somewhat successful. I think we're in a different political era now. I think we're seeing that crack up of that consensus that somehow trickle-down economics will work, that somehow, you know, a corporation like Walgreens or Burger King should be able to move its headquarters overseas so as not to pay any taxes at all and meanwhile pay their workers less than a living wage. You know, that has come to public attention, and there is a lot of interest in that. There's going to be a huge fast food workers walkout on Thursday this week, again, to bring attention to the need for a living wage for folks.
And yet, if all that is true, it would portend good times for progressives, good times for Democrats. And polling is showing that Republican voters are much more engaged in the elections at this point, which, as we know, is a very important predictor of turnout. So what gives?
Well, there are a lot of drivers of interest and engagement in elections. And I think that Wisconsin Public Radio callers who have been making this point over and over again that they don't feel adequately represented by Democratic politicians is part of the answer to that question. You know, I mean, it's true that you might be crazy to vote for a candidate who thinks that corporations should pay no taxes and we should, you know, gut your public school system. On the other hand, people are not feeling adequately represented by Democrats. You know, Mike McCabe, who's an outgoing head of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, has a stump speech where he talks about how there's one party that's scary and there's one party that's scared. And people never ask which party is which when he gives that speech. He's just written a book about that, how the Democratic Party really needs to reconnect with the grassroots, and that in the Depression, people had no question who was on their side. You know, whether it was rural electrification, whether it was the satellite UW system schools, you know, there was one thing after another the Democratic Party was trying to do for people who were working and struggling and facing hard times. And that needs to be true again in order to really energize voters to come out for Democrats.
More phone calls in a moment. Ruth Conniff is our guest, and we're doing an All Things Political on Tuesday of this week because we were off yesterday. She is editor of the Progressive magazine. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. We do want to talk a little bit about some foreign affairs issues that are very much with us. And also, she's done a really interesting piece on charter schools and FBI raids of charter schools. Make sure that we allow enough time for that this hour. More phone calls momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right. Our number is 800-486-8655. Just briefly, we should talk to you about this for another whole show, but I had no idea the FBI was raiding as many charter schools as they are.
I know. Wasn't that a great little
piece of information? It was really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so that came off of a tip from one of the people that writes for the website that we created, The Progressive, called Public School Shakedown, which is looking at education privatization all across the country. And if you look at local news reports and you start collecting them, you can see that the FBI has been raiding one school after another. And these are private entities that are taking advantage of changes in the law. And we've seen this here in Wisconsin. Many of these laws were written at ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. You know, corporations and right-wing legislators get together to draft boilerplate legislation to expand the ability of private entities to get public funds to run their own schools that have less oversight, less regulation than the regular public schools. And this has exploded in the last 10 years. And over the last year and a half, the FBI has been looking into what amounts to a racket, which is, you know, really shady operators coming into communities, getting a lot of money from the taxpayers to set up schools that are substandard and that are doing all kinds of illegal things, whether it's in Arizona, where a man who runs a company to make airplanes runs an elementary school and then uses funds to purchase planes for a flight school that's associated with that, purchasing them from his own company, pays himself hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and then takes these profits. Or it's rocket Ship, which is a big charter school company that comes out of California, whose board of directors, it's a nonprofit, but its board of directors is comprised of folks who, in their for-profit life, produce a software called Dreambox. And all the rocket ship schools that are popping up are required to use Dreambox, even though the Department of Education has found it to be a very poor product, and that the results that it gets educationally are very poor. So, you know, there are a lot of ways that people are finding to siphon money out of the public schools to enrich themselves. And when I called the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., they confirmed that they have been working with the Department of Education to identify these shady operators and to bust them all over the country.
We'll have to do more on that later. Bill in Marshfield. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It may be a little bit late, but I feel strongly that the previous caller that said he wasn't going to vote at all is part of a massive problem that we have in getting reasonable people elected to office. And I go around and tell teenagers all the time that when they can vote, they should vote in both primaries and especially the elections. Because if we all voted, I think that we would not have near the problems that we're having now. And so it is really anti-intellectual not to vote at all. So
I'm with you on that, Bill. I really love to vote, and there are a lot of things to vote for. And I am just, I'm astounded when I look at what turnout is. Aren't you, Ruth, for elections? Because it's, you know, we live in here. We got to vote. You got to vote. It's almost a duty. It's something you do. You vote.
Well, you know, in Australia, it's required by law. And I think if we had 100% voter turnout, we would have very, very different results.
We probably would, wouldn't we?
But we'd also have different candidates. And so there's a subtlety here. I think you can't just bludgeon people into voting for the candidate who manages to make the hurdle of raising enough money to be on the ballot. I think you have to talk to people where they are and look at what their concerns are. And, you know, you saw this in the Supreme Court hearing on voter ID, where it became clear that the lawyers representing the state of Wisconsin truly could not imagine a situation in which it would be too high a hurdle to go down to the DMV on one day and try to get ID, and then failing that, go to a separate government office and pay money for a set of documents to show that they were who they were, and then leave work on another day and go to another office to get ID in order to be able to vote. People have a hard time. You know, some people in our society work really, really hard and can't get time off of work, you know, don't feel represented by the candidates, feel kind of alienated, frankly, by the candidates. And I think we need to do something about that first, rather than just scolding people about voting. And at the same time, I agree with you. We would have a different world if we didn't have poor voter
of the
turnout.
Lack of voter turnout by the, by liberals and Democrats, we allowed the 2010 election and therefore the Congress and Senate to be hijacked for the majority of President Obama's tenure. And we're seeing the results of that.
And, I agree with you about
that. It's a great disservice to this country that we don't vote. People die to protect the right to vote. And yet we don't do it voluntarily.
Well, I think that is a really interesting point, and it is a point that I think it evaded Karl Rove in the 2012 presidential election, that actually the efforts to prevent particularly low-income black people from voting were so resonant with the voter suppression in the civil rights era and the people who did die to get that right, that we saw voters line up around the block. It was unsuccessful in delivering Ohio for the Republicans. And so I do think that people connect with that idea. And I also think we need to do things like really revitalize our political culture and, you know, really push for action on issues that matter to people, whether it's student debt, whether it's frac sand mining, whether it's the mine up north in Wisconsin, to get people out and get them participating and feeling like they can be effective in politics.
Thank you, Bill, for your call. Terry in Shatek. Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to make a couple of comments here.
All right.
I don't want Wisconsin to look like Mississippi. I want Wisconsin to look like Minnesota, for crying out loud. And second of all, we don't have a very deep bench when it comes to Wisconsin progressives. And I think Ruth touched on that earlier, but it's very disturbing. Other than Russ Feingold, I can't name anybody beyond him. And in Minnesota, you can name probably 10 or 12 politicians over there that are progressive. We don't have any over here. I'm embarrassed.
Ruth.
Well, I think that's beginning to shift. You know, we've got Melissa Sargent, we've got Diane Hesselbein, we've got a class of Chris Larson. You know, there are some younger Democrats. I mean, I think just the age demographic alone in the Democratic versus Republican Party should give people pause. You know, we're running Hillary Clinton for president, it looks like. You know, we've got very few young comers. You know, you look at Paul Ryan and Scott Walker and that whole class of young Republican rising stars, and you see that the right wing is doing something there that the Democratic Party is not doing. And so I think that is an absolutely identifiable issue.
I want to ask just briefly, we'll go back to phone calls momentarily, but this ISIS situation is just not getting any better, and it's hard to understand that how barbaric these people are. And then the president last week, and he took some criticism. I'm wondering if you think it was justified criticism for saying, well, we don't really have a strategy yet for dealing with Islamic extremists in Syria. Frank Bruni in today's New York Times said not having a strategy is understandable, but because the options aren't clear. But announcing as much, it's hard to see anything in that. It gives no comfort to Americans. It puts no fear in our enemies. Were you disappointed with the president's response? Do you think we need a strategy and we darn well better get one together in a hurry?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was a ridiculous thing to say. You know, nobody wants to hear that. That's politics 101. Mm-hmm. The reality, unfortunately, is it's hard to figure out what the winning strategy is. I mean, I think we're reaping the whirlwind from this neocon push to go bomb Iraq into the Stone Age, the idea that we could wage this eternal war on terror and that wiping out Osama bin Laden would mean that we no longer faced a terrorist threat. I mean, in a way, the nightmare vision that was contained in Bush's phrase, the axis of evil, is coming into reality now. We don't have a secular government that we can negotiate with and deal with anymore. And we have this, you know, puppet government in Iraq. You know, we have a really critically disastrous situation. And it's a real loss because mm-hmm. there was a moment of hope when Obama mm-hmm. came into office, when he was welcomed and embraced by the rest of the world. And we were really going to turn the page and we were going to have this hopeful era of diplomacy and not this bellicosity. Mm-hmm. And instead, you know, we're waging drone warfare. Guantanamo is still open. And we don't have a strategy.
Yeah. People are being beheaded, journalists.
And people are being beheaded.
It's sickening. It's really sickening.
It's horrifying.
Yeah. Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I think people don't vote because they are cynical and feel that they aren't listened to by politicians. David Obey was on Joy Cardine's show this morning and talking about lack of civic engagement. But David Obey headed straight to K Street as soon as possible after he left office to become a shadow lobbyist, just like his son in D.C. And his salary was being paid by his firm's clients, which have included Goldman Sachs, Monsanto, United Healthcare, Peabody Coal, Boeing, Visa. Young people especially, we can't get a meeting with our representatives because they are instead too busy meeting with these lobbyists.
Ruth.
Yeah, I mean, there is an opening here. You know, Eric Cantor's defeat by his Tea Party challenger, who spent a lot of his campaign pointing out that Eric Cantor had this big Rolodex of Wall Street donors, which is really confirmed today with the news that he's now gone to work on Wall Street.
Right.
There is an opening here. There are a lot of people of a lot of different political views and affiliations who feel not well represented by their political leaders in Washington. And I think there's a possibility. We see these big points of light. We see Elizabeth Warren, you know, we see Bernie Sanders, we see other candidates who are really tapping into that populist sentiment. And I think there's a potential for something big to happen. And that's, you know, that's why we're bringing people together on September 13th for Fighting Bob Fest. And that's why, you know, I see real hope in the student movement, you know, to do something about student debt. You know, politicians will follow if people get organized and push these issues. And if they're pushed out of office by upstart underfunded challengers.
Quickly, two more calls if we can do it. Ron and La Crosse. Almost out of time, Ron.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, these conflicting figures I'm seeing on TV ads from the Walker camp and the Burke campaign on where Wisconsin stands on job creations, and I'm also writing an email here, but I think since Walker's the incumbent, it's incumbent upon him to really, of course, he won't let the chips fall where they may. What type of jobs? Do they pay a living wage? How about benefits? How many are just part-time jobs that don't provide benefits? And here's an interesting question. How many of those jobs, what percentage of those new jobs created since Walker's been in office are up in those frac sand mines?
All right, Ron, I have to hold you there. We have about 30 seconds left. Can we find the truth when it comes to jobs?
Absolutely. This is not complicated. You don't have to dig that deep. You know, the fact is, Walker promised to create 250,000 new jobs. My colleague Mary Batari crunched the numbers and came up with 5,800 jobs that the WEDC could legitimately say it oversaw the creation of. And then during that same period, the state lost 13,000 jobs. So it's a terrible record, and it's impossible to defend. So I think when you hear Walker making evasive statements on it, he never tries to say he actually created all those jobs because they're not there.
Thanks very much for the call, Ron. And Ray, we'll just say what you wanted to say. I'm sorry. These aren't completely your words, but a caller said that Mary Burke needs to communicate her personal story, which is not a bad one. It's a good one about the way she lives. So we pass that along. Ruth, thank you very much. Join us again soon, please.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks
Good.
For having me.
Thank you. Ruth Conniff, our guest editor of The Progressive. Thanks to Judith Sears Poisson for producing this hour and to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We'll be back.